with the familiar smell of frying onions and chuck as his phone began to sing Bye Bye Blackbird, a ring he'd never programmed but couldn't resist. He picked it up, watched his thumb almost autonomously touch answer. He raised the haunted device to his ear. Hello? Hey, Jasper, a familiar voice, effusively friendly, a little loud, a man speaking against his own deaf ear. You watching the hockey? Hello? What am I always telling you and your brother? Take the body. Take the body! You don't let a man stand in your crease, Dad. You take him out! Dad? Hey, you got a good one for you. Two guys walking down the street. One of them says, hey, wa. Dad, no. Says, hey, we all got you. Now from the phone came the old hypomanic squealing that his father would leave on his answering machine after jokes begun predictably, then ended in racing aphasia that left Carrie afraid that genes were prophecy, that they would, in time, deliver him to the same place where his father, Percy, suffered. And where, in this moment, tears streaming down his face, peering through the foyer to see Wink and Al gazing puerilely at him, hot off the sight of a breakdown, it seemed he'd finally arrived. He smoked a bowl of indica, hoping for calm, nearly finding it. Coyotes started yipping in the canyons, the animals celebrating a feast, sending a fenour through his body. In childhood, he and his cousin Tom had played a game called Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, they chanted in the stairwell of his grandmother's tenement, trying to summon the spirit of a demon. Once, on the third chant, a blood-curdling scream had issued from down below them, sending a chill up his spine, raising the hairs on his head. He invented a word to describe the feeling. A fenour. And what he felt now, against the coyote's frenzied howling, was beyond any ordinary fenour. It made him fear for his own skin, made him recall how years before his daughter, Jane, would come to him at night shaken and afraid, reporting a presence in her bedroom. A psychic had said it was the spirit of a pioneer woman who'd fallen into the ravine back in the days of Spanish rule, had broken her leg and gone into shock, rousing to find her only child, a daughter, missing. Then hearing the little girl's screams against the feasting yips of coyotes in the distance. She has dark hair with gray in it, and she's screaming in your face, the psychic told him. She's trying to scare you away. She lost her daughter, and she wants yours. Following this report, Carrie had begun to sense the presence himself, had always imagined the spectral pioneer woman as a deranged Nancy Reagan. Tonight, the ghost came for him. Tossing in bed, he dreams that he's given Georgie all the children she's asked for, not one or two, but a dozen or so. He's the kind of man who can handle it all. They're sleeping in a nursery down the hall, a huge number of infants, a litter, really. As he rises to check on them, he hears demonic breaths, like from the flared nostrils of a bull. Distress curdles Georgie's perfect sleeping face. He hurries toward the nursery, lowers his shoulder into the door. It opens just 6 inches, then meets an awesome strength. He sees, through the slat, Nancy Reagan's unearthly black eyes, her razor-sharp teeth, bloodied off his baby's flesh. She slams the door. All he hears is infant wails, tearing flesh, tiny carcasses thudding off the walls as she discards them, gnawed bare like chicken wings. She's eating his children, you must understand, his tender children with Georgie, Georgie who left him weeks ago, who took his Frida Kahlo, who won't return his calls. A week became two, then a month. 30 years earlier at Dangerfield's Comedy Club, a bartender named Tony, a man who may or may not have killed some guys, had planted his finger into Carrie's chest and told him sagely, "You got a divine spark. You got to protect it." Now he recalled those words, fearing that his terrors were a function of the spark having died. His nights were haunted, his days without peace, fouled by clouds of ash and ceaseless construction noises. directly across the ravine a Russian oligarch. Mikhail Zavinikov had bought and raised 4 bungalows, joining the lots, building there a house whose sole reason for being was to launder his dirty money. And as Zavinikov's filthy billions were without end, so too was his construction. The initial phase, finished 6 months ago, threw up a smug black ziggurat trimmed in red steel. Kerry had thought it was over. Then work crews and heavy equipment had arrived and begun compounding the monstrosity, adding an aquarium, a disco, a 10-car garage, water features that never stopped running, and a rooftop pool whose grand colonnaded cabana paid homage to the Bolshoi, outside of which Zavinikov had gotten his start scalping tickets, a showbiz origin that worsened everything by suggesting that in some taunting way, the son of a bitch belonged here. Thundering pile drivers, raging drills, belching backhoes, they gave Kerry no peace. His mind increasingly resembled the parliament of some ludicrous Balkan republic. There was an anti-hippos faction blaming the pro-Maoists for their failed art project. There was a Georgie did this to us party whose intelligence held that his ex-lover had recently sold a screenplay to Catherine Bigelow, which Variety was calling Oscar-worthy, running a picture of her at a London dinner party seated happily between Tom Waits and Justin Trudeau. This news roiled the whole parliament, spawning a betrayal caucus that was in truth but the puppet of a jealousy block, itself merely cover for an abandonment front that, once identified, hastily rebranded itself Need a Pizza. He had a special pie-sized slot with a thermal receiving box installed in his front gate, and through this, several times a week, received large pies with supreme toppings, accompanied by sides of cinnamon sticks with extra frosting. He'd scurry out to retrieve them like a feral child, waiting till the delivery boy had driven off to avoid any human interaction, sometimes wearing a terry cloth robe, most times nothing at all, always scampering back to the house, fearing the baby-eating Nancy Reagan. Then he'd lose all fears in gluttoning until the food was gone, his mind reset to grumbling. There's not one cell in my body that's the same as it was 7 years ago. Where'd that guy go? The person I was. If he can vanish, what am I? To what place, he wondered, did past selves go? Was it the same place from which, still in the weeest of hours, he'd received calls from his dead father, still spewing gibberish tongues? And he'd take the calls, because how would Percy feel if he found a way to dial collect from the beyond and then got sent to voicemail by the son to whom he'd given all his dreams? So Kerry would answer, "Hello? Wafagawa, wafagawa, Dad, speak to me. Speak. The next afternoon, a text came from Nick Cage. Just won a 6th-century sword at Sotheby's in London. You gotta see the precision, the pride, the craftsmanship. The Saudis got a lot of money, man. I really had to chase this fucker. It's fucking Excalibur, Jimmy. Can I hide out at your Malibu pad for a while? Why? I got a beef with some otherworldly assholes." "Sure," replied Kerry. "Enjoy it." He plopped onto his bed. Soft sheets, cool pillows. He turned on Netflix and let its warm glow wash over him. Its algorithms guide him. Chapter 11. And now we return to the moment when we first met Jim Kerry. He watched a documentary claiming irrefutable evidence that the Earth's alien masters would soon come to deliver the planet from its pains. He watched it in shaking wonder, the TV's streaming images soon feeling oracular, more powerful and reliable than the fracas of his own mind. He watched thick-browed hominids capture fire. He watched the face of Christ reconstructed by quantum computers. He watched a team searching desperately for the lost manuscripts of William Shakespeare on Oak Island off Nova Scotia, where the Knights Templar had almost certainly buried them along with the Holy Grail. He watched Real Housewives of Beverly Hills having spirited Chardonnay fights. And he saw 4K digital renderings of Pangaea and the giant creatures of the ancient seas. He saw even his own younger self, a sketch from In Living Color, Krishna Cop, about a Hare Krishna cop who keeps reincarnating every time the bad guys kill him. He thought of those old days of Keenan and Damon Wayans, who had given him a beautiful place to flourish in the garden they worked so hard to create, of the late nights riding with Steve Oedekerk. He marveled at how the decades had just flown by, watching his comic self die and resurrect in the sketch again and again, ultimately achieving perfection as a holy crime-solving cow. He was left with a sense of time as insatiable, devouring even the gods with a BBC documentary about the last hours of Pompeii, the burying over of temples, the certainty of extinction that made billionaires plan Pyrrhic escapes to Mars. He was led then to a show called Afterlife, testimonials of sweet dopes who'd somehow gone to heaven and then come back to blather about it. The pure deliverance, the rapturous hope. Tears poured from Carrie's insomniac eyes as he watched, as he imagined the soul's flight from the body. Let go, let go, let go, he pleaded with himself again and again, trying to shed his human husk. But there was never any ascension. He stayed right where he was, dissected by the YouTube algorithms that soon deduced his guiding interest, suggesting he'd enjoy seeing history's top 10 celebrity autopsy photos. John F. Kennedy, face frozen in expiration, reddish-brown hair filthy with skull, brains, blood. A close-up of Michael Jackson's hand, a barcoded tag dangling where the sequined glove once shone. Bruce Lee, mouth stitched shut like a football, sinking into coffin satin. You're a commodity, just a commodity. Even when you're dead, it's not their fault, it's yours. You blooded the hounds. Jesus became a tax shelter. Fred Astaire's ghost selling dirt devil sweepers on late night TV. A shot of John Lennon, face puddled on a gurney. This man, the greatest poet-songwriter of Carey's lifetime, born in Liverpool during the Blitz. A working-class hero is something to be. Splayed out for the crowd, if they could do this to John Lennon. Carey went to the bathroom, scrubbed and made himself beautiful. He'd look dashing for generations as yet unborn, if his heart should fail him tonight. The clock read 5:17, 5:39. 6:40, and just as his eyes were closing. Construction resumed at Savonikov's mansion. New drills trucked in from fracking country. Mighty rock crushers that pound and blast send tremors through his windows and into his skull. No point in calling the police. The Russian was within his rights. So Carey fished a bottle of Ambien from the bedside table drawer, shook two pills into his palm, swallowed them. A memory of Helena San Vicente here, on this bed. A reconsideration of suicide, not as an act of desperation, but one of defiance. Another pill, then, finally, the gift of sleep. He woke to the face of his daughter Jane and his 6-year-old grandson Jackson, who covered his mouth and nose against the feeder of night sweats and dirty sheets, declaring, "Smells like butt in here, Grandpa." "You owe me $1 for swearing." "Butt isn't a swear word. It's on the edge. What's that?" Carey pointed to a tome in his daughter's hands. Dolores, Book of Greek Myths. "It's for Jackson's school. They're doing Greek mythology." "Read it, Mommy," said the boy. "I'd enjoy a story," said Carey. Jane opened the volume. This was his daughter, his beautiful daughter, whom he and his first wife, Melissa, had taken home from the hospital nursery to a studio apartment near MacArthur Park, who'd beamed purest joy from a wicker basket as he and Melissa read Fonte's Ask the Dust to each other on the fire escape. Now she read to him, flipping to a bookmarked page. Prometheus could not bear to see his people suffer, and he decided to steal fire, though he knew that Zeus would punish him severely. He went up to Olympus, took a glowing ember from the sacred hearth, and hid it in a hollow stalk of fennel. She passed the book to Jackson. "Show Grandpa how well you read now." Carrie sat up in the bed, giving his whole attention to the boy, who proudly took the book, staring intently, slowly moving through the text. "He carried it down to earth, gave it to mankind, and told them never to let the light from Olympus die out." The words were like water to Carrie's parched soul. "No longer did men shiver in the cold of the night, and the beasts feared the light of the fire and did not dare attack them." "God, that's beautiful," said Carrie, head falling back on the pillow. Then his grandson poked at his cheek with a hesitancy that reminded Jane of the young boy's manner earlier that month with a stick and a dead bird. And this moment, this pitying gaze from his six-year-old heir, replayed in Carrie's mind across the coming hours, translated into a resolve that if there was no reason to exist for his own sake, or even proof that he had ever existed for any sake, there was some reason to carry on for his little girl, for her little boy. "I'll take hippos," he texted Al Spielman. "What made you change your mind?" "I haven't." Let him have the last word, thought Spielman, marveling at how TPG's talent management, AI, had predicted that Carrie, if simply left alone and denied compliments of any kind, would accept the role in this 48-hour window. Chapter 12. The armored Escalade ground down a dirt path left off most maps. The landscape shed its gridded certainties, slow folded back into two-dimensional space, bands of ochre and blue. The American desert is a pram of horror and wonder, the world's last unfiltered portal to the beyond, a place where heaven and hell both touch the earth. He imagined a nervous Oppenheimer, shot in choppy black and white, chain-smoking in his worsted wools, leading the atom bomb down a sheep trail just like this one, toward the place where was unveiled Deus Ex Machina, history's ultimate plot device, the thing that might, to Carrie's view, with even odds, destroy everyone and everything except the data that the Earth shrieks out into space. He thought of his old tweets drifting through Alpha Centauri as the car came to a stop, churning up a dust cloud through which he saw five geodesic domes, all gleaming in the sun. He imagined them as giant eggs hatching baby serpents, the creatures slithering out, glistening with birthing goo, as a man and woman appeared from inside the central structure, greeting him with tight corporate smiles. "I'm Lala Hormel," said the woman, a rail-thin blonde in her mid-40s, blue contact lenses frauding brightly above her hazel eyes. He noticed her signet ring as they shook hands, gold engraved with a screaming falcon. "I'm the TPG partner in charge of Hollywood operations." "And I'm Satchel," said her junior associate, a pair of round glasses with prematurely thinning hair. "Satchel LeBlanc. I work with Lala." "I'm feeling better than ever," said Carrie, as per his team's suggestion, "and I'm ready to work again. How nice of you to say. I'm feeling so strong and excited to be back in the game. How good for us to hear that." Then, an antagonistic glimmer in his eyes, speaking just a bit too loud. "I play well with others." "We value that here," said Lala, taking him inside the complex, explaining, "This is all proprietary technology from our investments in Korea and Silicon Valley. We're 5 years ahead of the studios. That's pure competitive advantage, Jim." Holy shit, they've taken over, thought Carrie, as she walked him through the domes, each big enough for a 747. "We've got animators, programmers, and renderers. We've got genius sound engineers and augmented reality interfaces. We..." United Artists got close. Laserjack Lightning tried to do it. But where the artists all failed, a big pile of money is going to succeed. Here we have uncredited but well-compensated writers adjusting the script as our mainframes analyze all chamber output in real time. I feel like the first monkey in outer space. I'll just do what I'm told, see if I get a banana, he thought as they came to a pair of airlock doors. We have over $1 billion of technology here, said Lala, ushering him inside. A lot of baddies who just love to get their hands on it. The age of misinformation has only just begun. Now, if you don't mind. He was scanned for listening devices, then taken inside the control room. Concentric rows of computers and workstations set behind a one-way mirror, looking into a spherical beige performance space, the inner chamber. Seated at a central desk was the millennial George Lucas, Lanny Lonstein, a pudgy redhead compensating for a weak chin with a wispy goatee. His forearm freckles sparkled in the halogen light. Jim, meet Lanny, said Lala. Lanny, Jim. Jim Carrey, gasped Lonstein. At NYU, he'd astonished the faculty with his deep readings of film texts, his belief that they contained a magic only revealed when a culture, like a person, gave up its soul at life's end, that they revealed this meaning through repeated viewings, like recited prayer. I own all the mask dolls. I keep them in the original packaging. I've seen Ace Ventura 283 and a half times. That's an exact number. As a kid, I'd watch it over and over. At NYU, they told us we had to choose art or commerce. Ace taught me that was bullshit. Ace taught me you could pack the theaters while carrying out some brilliant fucking subversion. We were mocking the concept of the unbeatable leading man, said Carey. You were eviscerating the whole Puritan ideal, said Lonstein. And people love animals, said Lala. So many cute animals. I'd like to be alone with Jim, if that's okay, said Lonstein. Of course, said Lala, and left them there. I think cinema is, above all, a store of memory, said the director. Did you know that the first recorded memories were Babylonian seals? Little movie reels, carved rock cylinders that they'd roll onto clay, and out would come a story of a harvest or a flood or a hero. Nude bearded hero wrestling water buffalo, bullman fighting lion, the same man being received by an enthroned deity, apparently descended from a glowing orb. Ancient aliens, said Carey. I've seen that episode. Yes, the Babylonians believed they had extraterrestrial origins. They locked eyes. Jim, we are living through the largest mass extinctions ever of languages, of species. I want to make something to speak for us after we're gone. They think we're making some movie out of a tabletop game? Let them think that. Let them call it Hungry Hungry Hippos. We'll know what we're really doing, you and me. We'll know that we're here with their billions making the first human story ever recorded. I want to tell that first story to see us through these trying times. What story is that? The Epic of Gilgamesh. A soothing, sating aroma filled the air as Lonstein's assistant appeared with the meal that Carey ate. When he wanted to get back in shape but was not yet ready for the suffering of a real diet, 2 grilled nut cheese sandwiches on spelt bread with a bottle of organic ketchup and a frosty can of naturally flavored mango LaCroix. Lonstein watched, pleased, as the star began devouring. We think we're immune to massive cataclysms? Nothing could be further from the truth. Unfettered capitalism is destroying the world. It can't last. It yearns for its own destruction, said Carey. I think celebrity does too, said Lonstein. Celebrity, as we know it, is part of capitalism, unsustainable. I think that's why you all eat at the end. Who? Elvis, Liz Taylor, Bardo, Brando. All the real greats gorge toward the end. Carey paused, a long cheese strand hanging from his chin. Thanks? Don't take it the wrong way, just something I've observed. Michael Jackson would have been a parade float if it wasn't for his meds, said Carrie. That was his way of getting there. How do you mean? 50 years old? 50-city tour? Taking fentanyl to dance? Propofol to sleep at night? That's showing you the same thing. Which is what? That all personas eventually turn sarcophagal, said Carrie, plainly. And what's the natural thing to do in a sarcophagus? Die? Not before you try to claw your way out. So let's do this, said Lonstein. And Carrie, later on, would recall how Lanny's left hand trembled on the table, how his eyes had betrayed an almost sickly need of approval as the director took a deep breath and then belted out an eerily perfect, "All righty then." He was wearing a black motion capture bodysuit made of data relaying fibers and standing in the central chamber, equipped with the most precious fruit of TPG's entertainment foray, a pair of $1 million augmented reality goggles, one of only four in existence, a quantum leap in production technology designed to address a long-standing complaint of green screen actors, that it was hard to imagine a tennis ball as a Tyrannosaurus Rex. They looked like ordinary tanning goggles, just a bit bulkier, and promised to show him the mainframe-rendered scenes in real time. This is total immersion, the leap from acting to reacting, Lala had bragged, unpacking them. Don't drop them. Over half their estimated value came from projected pornography revenues. An ultraviolet laser light scanned Carrie's torso, his face, his legs, relaying all data to the mainframes that inserted him into the digital person of Morris Simmons, a middle American ad man on a wild journey. He watched with eerie fascination as the black bodysuit turned into pleated shorts, a Chicago Bears golf shirt with a bulging belly, as his forearms puffed up like pressed hams. He laughed for the first time in weeks. He felt so free that he danced, first cautiously, testing the speed of the rendering engines, then gaily, even merrily, awed by delightful illusion. His fingers, always slender, were suddenly a family of Vienna sausages. He waved them before his goggled eyes, was half tempted to bite one as Lonstein's voice came through his earpiece. A friendly note that your fingers are not edible. They look delicious! Just wanted to show you what this baby can do, said Lonstein, returning his digits to normal. Okay, let's start with scene 12, entry into Hippopotama. The chamber transformed, each beige panel generating pixels of glimmering wonder. A holographic hippo Babylon of terracotta houses protected by mighty walls. The depth of the rendering was simply awesome. He believed that every brick of the city had been baked in the sun. And then he gasped at the hippos themselves. Their features were endearingly cartoonish, but their flesh was so supple. Their eyes so vividly alive. He marveled at them, carrying a Dunlop 9-iron, walking through a crowded marketplace of mostly barren produce stalls. It was a scene of Black Friday bedlam, hippos battling to stuff their bags with desiccated mangoes. Then it became a proper melee. A newly arrived cart of mangoes had them gnashing their giant teeth, butting their massive skulls, drawing blood over fruit flesh, as fully savage an animal fight scene as a PG rating would allow. These undoubtedly, to any observer, were hungry, hungry hippos. There was no written script. The time costs of revision and the unpredictability of actors and writers from draft to draft had been deemed an inefficiency by TPG, replaced with autonomous dialogue generation. It's a little early for a hurly-burly, said a voice in Carrie's ear, a voice so much like his own and yet so much less taxing than original thought, that he almost accepted it as his true interior and didn't speak the line until prompted again. He lifted a single comic eyebrow. It's a little early for a hurly-burly. He'd nailed it. Then, just like in a movie. Trumpets blasted, a royal fanfare, and into the market came a hippo woman wearing a golden crown, the Hippo Queen, attended by 5 royal hippo guards whose presence stopped the violence. "Good hippos," said the Hippo Queen, voiced brilliantly by Dame Judi Dench. "We are all brothers and sisters, and we all have one enemy." She waited a ripe, dramatic beat. "Who is our enemy?" "The Hyena Queen," cried the crowd. "Yes," she gestured across the marketplace, so many barren farm stands. "She steals our precious mangoes, fouls our water. She eats our hippo babies, and her fang bacteria is so bad, if she bites you, you'll lose your mind." "She bit me once and I woke up married to a cocktail waitress in Reno," boomed a voice from across the square. Carrie turned to see a bipedal rhinoceros whose swaggering gait and red necktie struck him as familiar, even before all the hippos said, "It's Rodney the Rhino." This rhino bore strong resemblance to Rodney Dangerfield, the legendary comedian whom Jim had watched on the Ed Sullivan Show as a boy, not understanding the jokes, but laughing because his father was laughing, who, in Vegas 40 years before, had hired a young Jim as his opening act, mentoring him, believing in him, always watching his stand-up from the wings, laughing at his goofy innocence, whom Jim loved and admired, who had been dead for 15 years. "Rodney? Let's stay in the scene, Jim. Rodney's dead."
"You're not looking so hot yourself, kid," said the rhino as a voice in Carrie's earpiece explained.
"We've licensed his essence."
"That's a thing?"
"Yeah."
"Fuck me. Let's get back into it, okay? 1, 2, 3, and Rodney the Rhino, surveying all the woebegone hippopotami, continued his bit. "I always said it. You can't trust hyenas. They'll laugh at anything." He pointed to Carrie. "But this guy can save us."
"Me?"
"Yeah, you're the one who was promised."
"No way."
"Oh, yeah."
"Uh-uh."
He turned to the many hippos like they were a comedy club crowd, pulling at his necktie and rolling his eyes. "Must I always be wrong?" He pointed to Carrie's 9-iron.
"You're the one, I tell you. The guy from the scrolls of Hippopotama."
4 hippo high priests now appeared, unfurling a giant scroll to show a portly man with a short staff. Carrie raised his hands in protest, but as the sun gleamed from the golf club, all the hippos fell to their knees, convinced of his destiny. And if this all wasn't enough to move him, the promise of just another second or two with even the animal form of Rodney Dangerfield was.
"You're the guy who's come to save us," said Rodney, "to bring back the clean water and the mangoes and the kids. Because of you, we're all going to finally get the respect we deserve. You with me?"
And Carrie felt the right line birthed inside of him before anything came through his earpiece. He spoke it with his whole heart. "I'd go anywhere with you." Over the next month, in the semi-magical chamber, Jim and Rodney wandered far beyond Hippopotama. They battled marauding lions, roaring primal menace, and Rodney saved Carrie's life, goring 2 lionesses so gravely that the rest all retreated. Then they fought sadistic jackals, and here they were a team, Carrie riding Rodney like an armored tank, fending off the jackals with his 9-iron, cracking jokes about how his short game had never been so good. Then they rested on a lush hillside, full moon hanging above, the landscape's every pixel evoking Kenya's Masai Mara, Carrie laying his head on a foam block that he totally accepted as Rodney's rhino belly. And why not? It all seemed so much truer and richer than the gray world outside, where ashes flurried heavy from the west, fire season in the hills. In the chamber, the air was pure. He realized he didn't want to leave his friend's company. He loved how his life, or its forgery, was given meaning by their companionship, their shared noble mission. "That's a wrap," said a voice in his ear. And Carrie watched the rolling hills and the dusky sky dissolve. He mourned each fading pixel, the suddenly silent bird songs. "Can't we keep it running?" Across the one-way glass in the production room, Lanny Lonstein shared a knowing glance with Lala Hormel, who flashed him a cautious thumbs up. "Whatever you want, Chief." They ordered their teams to stay and set the computers to indulge all tangents, wanting to capture each moment of these friends reunited across the barrier of death. The stars surged back to life in the chamber's sky as the valley down below them filled with 1,000 elephants in silhouette. "Sometimes they overdo it just a bit," said Rodney. "Look, I know this isn't real," said Carrie, "but Jesus Christ, I've missed you, man." He choked up. "It's so nice to hear your voice." The rhino took offense.
"How do you know I'm not Rodney? Maybe this is just how us famous types carry on these days. Go ahead, give me a try. Ask me anything."
"Who's your favorite joke writer?"
"The great Joe Ancus."
"What was your favorite impression of mine?"
"The amazing fucking Kreskin, kid. Funniest thing you ever did. Too bad nobody in America cares who he is."
"Okay, that's pretty good, but people could Google that." Carrie thought hard, wanting equally to stump and to trust this machine. Something personal, between just the two of them, private, precious. "What did you say backstage at Caesar's Palace about having sex after 60?
"I need a champion cocksucker, man."
"How the fuck do you know that?" "The difference between a person and a computer isn't so great anymore, kid," said Rodney, gently rubbing Carrie's shoulder with his horn, the sensors of the bodysuit convincingly pulsing each caress.
"It's like it's really you," said Carrie. "My God." "Pretty swank, huh? Wish they had this before your dad died."
The cameras whirred along their cables, angling for Carrie's response. And a few of the renderers felt unease, even guilt, as they watched what followed. "I miss him," said Rodney.
"Man, Percy, that guy was hilarious."
"I feel like lately he's been trying to reach me."
"Reach you?"
Now Carrie unburdened himself, voice trembling. "He calls my cell phone, or something does. I answer. He starts telling me a joke, then he falls off into gibberish, this high-pitched squealing. It's exactly what he did after my mom died. He lost his way at the end. He just had glitches, kid."
"Glitches?"
"Yeah, glitches," said Ronnie. "Take a look at those elephants down there. A couple of them have been beeping in and out of existence this whole time. But you know what? You can fix anything in post. And meanwhile, look at these stars. You ever seen the moon so clear? They got so much of it right." Rodney took an appreciative pause. "Just like your dad." Carrie's eyes welled tears.
"You want to see another little glitch?" asked Rodney, a mischievous glint in his eye.
He stood, turned, raised his flap-like rhino tail.
"I got no asshole. They didn't give me an asshole. I eat half my body weight every day, and I can't shit."
Now they were bonded, the truest of friends. Their laughter echoed across the chamber. It seemed to go on forever, each note fully captured by the watching and listening computers. They roamed the digital savanna like Gilgamesh and Enkidu, sharing bits of their backstories, Lonstein grinning as Carrie told Rodney of the time he'd gotten ambushed by a boy with a pea shooter in a Toronto apartment block. The time, age 11, when he'd gotten caught humping the little green rug beside his parents' bed. Soon, Carrie missed Rodney when they weren't together. At night, in his sleeping quarters, he'd lie down on a Spartan cot, watching CNN, its resolution nowhere near as compelling as the scenes in the chamber. A billionaire casino magnate was running for president. His whole campaign, a churlish collection of grimaces and playground insults. It was widely known that he kept a whole floor of prostitutes in the Vegas Tower where he lived in a duplex penthouse, a situation that might have been legal in the state of Nevada if he didn't get off on pummeling them all. It began with one lawsuit, then grew into dozens, more women emerging from across the years. Pictures of bruised,
necks, broken noses, stories of choking to the point of unconsciousness. Threats made against their lives and the lives of those they loved. Their images and accounts sprawled across the news. But where these ought to have ended the magnate's candidacy, they only fueled it. His base almost completely accepted his defense, that the women were mostly lazy millennials unfit for a challenging work environment. He was surging in the polls. And against this all, the New York Times ran an article reporting that Navy pilots had filmed close encounters with stunningly advanced UFOs, that the government had multiple buildings storing parts of flying saucers just outside Las Vegas, strange metals defying identification. The story fueled light Twitter comedy, then joined into the ever louder background noise. The world he saw on the news came to seem like a genre-fusing farce, its storylines ever less plausible, ever more dispiriting. The world of the chamber, by contrast, was all impressionist masterworks, images, and plot lines, manifestly finer and more nourishing than what, of late, was passing for the real. Time behaves strangely on a movie set. Days lurch into months. Seasons blur together. The sun was falling. He and Rodney were camped by a thin river, resting by a fire. Carrie was so certain, having left the script far behind, that a shining achievement was just within their reach. They'd defeat the hyena queen. They'd restore all the fish to the hippo river, and all the mango groves and all the hippo children would sleep well and safe. And he'd get a big summer movie to boot. Ego and soul in rarest unison. He looked hopefully around the shadowy savannah and heard excited giggles. "Sounds like someone's having a party," he said. "Shh," said Rodney, tiny ears perking up with alarm. Then he whispered, "I know what a party is, kid. That's no party, let me tell you." The yipping giggles built, bouncing across the chamber. Technicians peering like prison shrinks through the one-way glass. They'd been coding the scene for months, wanted to see what would win, the engineered mind or the human one, once all data was distilled and looped into the mainframes. Hyena eyes now appearing through the grass, deep voids set with amber irises kicking back the firelight. Two sets of eyes. 5. 7. 8 slobbering hyenas slowly taking form from the shadows, coats foul with mange and gore. Lonstein had given. And now, in homage to the original Gilgamesh, who lost his heart when he lost Enkidu, he would take. "Rodney," Carrie cried, right atop the voice in his ear. The hyenas raced in from all sides, a rush of gnashing teeth and fur. Rodney, ever faithful, gathered to his feet, started swinging his great horn. He shattered one beast's skull, saying, "Oopsie," then launched another through the air, quipping, "Is that the best you got? You fight like a bunch of pink flamingos." Then, as if to answer his challenge, two other hyenas leaped on his neck. They clawed at his eyes, bit into his ears. Carrie swung his 9-iron madly, trying to fend them off as more beasts were rendered into the scene, leaping atop Rodney, fangs finding his soft stomach, tearing into his guts, blood spraying in the firelight, Carrie wailing at once to the fates and the control room. "What the fuck? It's too much!" Lenny Lonstein marveled at his own genius, knowing he'd lose most of the gore in his final cut, but thrilled at how it had Carrie reduced to survival mode, totally convinced of the carnage, all his efforts useless against the moment's single narrative demand that Rodney was to die, but Jim would survive and yet be changed. "Take me! Take me!" he screamed, these ad-libbed lines freed from cliché by raw fear that drove the digital engines to detect approaching climax. "Stay with it," said Lonstein, directing his programmers to complete the moment with a suddenly materialized 13th beast, greater and more terrible than the rest,
surging up from behind him, the hyena queen, fangs like steak knives, eyes so knowingly evil that Carrie wets his bodysuit as the hyenas feasted on poor Rodney, their cackles multiplying, filling the star with a sorrow that rose like floodwaters over what rubbled walls still stood between his experiences in the chamber and his existence beyond it. The hyenas slowly vanished. Rodney's rhino form remained, bleeding out into the grass. His breaths growing ever more shallow, great bulging eyes fighting to stay open. "Rodney," said Carrie, holding a block of foam he thought of as the body of his friend. Through this whispering, he recalled a room at UCLA Hospital a decade before, when Dangerfield was in his final hours, breaths short and labored as they were now. He'd leaned close and gifted his friend a final joke. "Don't worry, Rodney. I'm going to let everyone know that you're really gay. That kind of thing isn't frowned on anymore." The machines had come to life. The nurses all came running. Dangerfield had started moving his lips, trying to form words, but failed. Rodney the Rhino's eyelids shut. His body vanished into nothing. The sound design cut. No more rustling grass, just the white whir of air conditioning. "I want Rodney," said Carrie. "Bring him back." "That can't be done," said a voice like his own voice in his ear. "Bring him back or I'm off this film." "He's gone," said the voice coolly. "Bring back Rodney." "That's it," said Lonstein. "Gorgeous loss." "No, this is genius, Jim. I want Rodney back." "He's gone," said the voice in his ear. "Not coming back." "Then I'm out." Carrie tore at the cameras on his head brace, each a $100,000 prototype. He ripped them and threw them to the ground, stomped them to bits, jumping up and down on the mess of plastic and wiring like a child wrecking a Lego castle. "Bring back Rodney," he tapped on his goggles. "I want to see him." This only further excited the other cameras. "I'll fuck you up, too." They whirred closer. "I'm not your monkey," said a voice in his earpiece, a voice closer to his own truth than ever before. And as this scared him, he changed the line. "I'm not some puppet." "Control yourself," said a new voice, Al Spielman the second. "I'm in control. You're hopping around like a madman," which only deepened his rage. He leaped up to grab at the cameras on the rigging. A $10 million cluster of technology whose contractual protections exceeded his own. The chamber doors opened. Out came Wink and Al, Lonnie and Lala, followed by Satchel LeBlanc, carrying a silver tray of crystal flutes brimming with champagne. "What the fuck is this? We're here to toast you." "For what?" "Extraction," said Lonstein. "Few people have uploaded so much so quickly. The engineers have everything they need for Hippos. And for all the sequels." "Sequels? If you agree." "Why would I agree?" "Because quantum computers are smoking," said Lonstein, with a pathetic attempt at a mask-evoking spin. "Jesus, Murphy," muttered Carrie. "And because we can guide you," said Lala, "not just through this film, but beyond it." "I don't want to be guided." "Choice is an illusion, Jim," said Wink. "Jury's in on that one." "By accepting this, though, you make perhaps the ultimate choice, a choice that can free you to prosper into eternity, the first artist freed from time. The AI makes better decisions than 1,000 geniuses in a think tank," said Al. "And happiness and success? They all boil down to decision-making." "We at the Texas Pacific Group want to help you," said Lala, "to guide your brand through an endless chain of profitable tomorrows." The chamber now filled with visions of possible Jim Carreys, vastly happier, more youthful and beautiful than the actual Jim Carrey, all fixed in an unending 35th year. He spun in wonder as the scenes appeared. He saw himself yachting off Nantucket with Oprah, Tom Hanks, and the Obamas, all equally ageless, laughing at a joke he just told. He saw himself playing touch football with the young Bobby and Jack Kennedy in Hyannis,
scoring a goal with a bicycle kick in a World Cup final, swimming among orcas off Maui, the mightiest of them jumping up out of the water, soaring over his head, its tender belly just grazing the fingers of his outstretched hand, a la Free Willy. Then a final tableau consumed all others, transforming the chamber into Athens as seen from the terrace of a mountain villa overlooking a perfectly restored Parthenon. He saw his parallel self in a loosely tied toga, ancient sun gleaming from his eight-pack with the brilliance of 1,000 Atlantean power spheres. The Parthenon looks gorgeous. Jim Carrey paid for the restoration, said Al. Passive income, buddy. The deal is historic, said Wink. You'll never stop making money, but that's not all. Then the room filled with the scene of a future Oscar ceremony. He was sitting in the audience, Daniel Day-Lewis presenting at the podium, tearing open a thick envelope, announcing that the Best Actor award goes to... You fuckers, thought Carey. It felt so real. Jim Carrey, said the legendary thespian, not with surprise, no, but with satisfaction, his face registering joy and relief, as if a grave wrong had finally been righted, as if the fact of this occurrence made the world a more just and habitable place. Carey spun to see all the joyful faces, wild applause exploding across the speakers. Daniel Day-Lewis was double-pounding his heart with his fist. Sweet Christ, the bliss of this! The soaring validation! He walked toward Lewis, dopamine invigorating his every cell, and just as he was about to reach the Dolby Theater stage, the mirage disappeared. Not reality yet, said Wink. Still just a good dream. What do I have to do? We've already gathered all your data. Just say the word. They can complete this film and the next one. And you? You can get some rest. Go paint. I'm an artist, said Carey. I don't let some computer do my work. Tell it to Jeff Koons, said Wink. Guy hasn't made a balloon dog in forever. They're pulling down all the statues of Elvis in Vegas, said Al. Young kids don't give a gnat shit who he is. That's not your fate. You'll last forever. Forever. The word had a ring to it. Carey imagined his digital essence speeding across the cosmos, fists thrust ahead of it, Superman style, zooming gallantly past Alpha Centauri, then through quasars and nebulae, finally beyond the dream-soaked edge of the thing. Forever, said Carey, finding it the happiest of words. You'll be there for your daughter, your grandson, his children. No more struggles, said Wink. No early morning call times. The Oscar scene passed to a vision more alluring than all the rest. His bedroom back on Hummingbird Lane, a still night, no construction noises, and at the center of the composition, his bed. His soft, beloved bed. Home, said Wink. No place like it. Rest, relax, said Al. You can still work anytime you want, but let the future take its course. Now a Jim Carrey perfectly identical to his own present self appeared on the bed, wrapped in his own bathrobe, face a vision of tranquility. So happy. Such harmony. So very cruelly and irresistibly possible. He felt an eerie unity as this phantom extended its hand, beckoning him to come closer. He stepped hesitantly toward it, admiring the rendering work. His face, just like his face. His eyes, just like his eyes. The moonlight fell over each of them as they stood there, each form joining seamlessly with the other, the virtual and the real becoming indistinguishable. Both selves whispering, okay, in unison. Okay, okay. The cotton duvet, just as fine as he remembered. The great mattress, just as welcoming as it had always been as he fell onto it,
exhausted, sighing deeply, almost prayerfully. Chapter 13. Fire! 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 Please leave immediately. He was at home, or so it seemed, lying in his bed. Jofield cowered in the bathroom doorway. Shuv, he called, the Hebrew command for come, and they trotted reluctantly to his side as he peered through the blinds, out into a jaundiced haze. A burning eucalyptus tree had fallen out of the pool house, collapsing the roof into a pyre. Threat inventory, he said to the house. The cabana is ablaze. Outdoor temperature, 150 degrees. Please leave immediately. The fires never get to Brentwood. Adjacent homes are aflame. The fires won't leap over the canyon. We disagree. The digital woman had only ever spoken in the first person singular. Why this shift into the plural? How did she know about other houses? Did these semi-sentient security systems swap celebrity secrets? He rose with cracking knees, pulled on his bathrobe, and haunched down the hallway, Rottweilers at his sides, windows flickering crimson. Looking outside, he saw the burning ravine, flames reaching 20, 30 feet skyward, blasting embers into the devil winds. Up over his yard, the lawn already strewn with flames. He opened the door. The curtains writhed like tortured spirits as a thermal blast screeched inside, searing his skin as he stepped onto the patio, the whole world like a sweat lodge. He choked on the scalding air, pulled his t-shirt over his mouth and nose, then settled into a cedar lounge chair. The fires had never come this close before. The oligarch's mansion was entirely ablaze, gulping oxygen at its base, spouting fountains of flame as the tractors and rigs that had pulverized Carrie's mornings spewed fire from their bellies. The cell networks were all jammed, but Avi Ayalon had gotten a text through saying he'd evacuated Jane and Jackson from Laurel Canyon, but the police and fire departments were blocking the roads into Brentwood. Avi advised him to take the Range Rover and meet them up north. Tell Jane I love her, Carrie replied, but the message kept failing to send. Down at the Russian compound, a fuel truck met the flames, its tires popping as prelude to the gas tank explosion shattering the glass on the mansion's northeast facade. How very beautiful, thought Carrie, transfixed. Let nature have her way. Erase this eyesore. Cleanse the land and return it to the wild things. A pale apricot glow to the north. Greater fires there, exquisitely rendered. Music flowed from one of the burning houses, arpeggiated notes filling the night with a plaintive grandeur. It sounded like a Philip Glass score. The last he knew, he was in a geodesic dome in the desert, settling down for a digital nap. Had Wink and Al dealt him into the disaster genre? Was this reality? He unlocked his iPhone and opened Twitter, where trending news headlines seemed to verify the crisis. Fires beyond control, only 5% contained. Hashtag fire selfie was trending. People competing to live stream their adrenaline-flushed faces from as close to the biggest blazes as possible. Daring each deathward, many vanishing into the smoke, all for the likes of total strangers. The eastern winds roared, fanning the central ravine fires to 60 feet, glowing embers wafting across Carrie's lawn, over his house. He held up his arms, totally covered in ash. He saw his reflection in the glass doors, the flaky sediment covering his hair, his shoulders, too. He seemed like an elderly version of himself, grayed by time. He smiled, imagining himself blowing away, joining with the dust. He was calm, resigned, almost Buddhist in tranquility. His Mao preparations, his deep dives into historically dubious yet still terrifying documentaries, had filed down death's fangs. He'd lived through the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. This was nothing. Then, leaping from the fires, shattering all calm. A mountain lion sprinted straight at him, incisors bared, gaining 15 feet with each bound. Carrie's inner peace dissolved in a scream. Jophiel launched to defend him, steel fangs gleaming, countercharging the great cat, all animal bodies meeting in a tangle of claws and muscle as beyond them a fire tornado swirled up from the hulk of the Russian house and began moving toward the hummingbird estate. "Shuv!" cried Carrie, but the dogs ignored him. "Shuv!" he repeated, again ignored by the Rottweilers, who'd clamped their teeth into the mountain lion's neck, refusing to let go even as the great cat buckled and bled. Finally, despairing, Carrie gave the one command that would override their programming. "Ahava," he said, the Hebrew word for love. It worked. For the animals, as for the man, the memory of a mother's love was overriding. They turned from the wounded cat toward the great house as the fire tornado swirled closer to them with unexpected speed. The dogs raced but were overtaken mid-stride by the firestorm. Carrie ran inside, thinking first of himself, then of his exquisite art. His Picasso, one of the guitar series, a seminal cubist work unveiled at the 1915 Armory Show. His Basquiat, flash in Naples. His gorgeous Hockney, Alliums. "I have to save them for prosperity," he thought, then paused, shocked and appalled at the Freudian slip. Prosperity? Is that what had been running his show? He gave the thought a second take, revising it toward a more noble motivation. "I have to save them for posterity." But he couldn't sell the line. The first take was better. Siegfried's funeral march from Götterdämmerung came over the home's audio interface, selected by the security system, which, sensing its plastic components beginning to melt, thought it time to say farewell. Against rising brass and strings, Carrie recalled a treasure more precious than all others. Charlie Chaplin's cane, won at auction in 1995 with his payday from Batman Forever. It was, upon purchase, his most sacred object, affirming his arrival, fulfilling his very spirit. Chaplin had not merely impressed, but formed him, showed him how any gesture, a kiss, playing with some bread rolls, can be freed from the mundane, imbued with magic. Charlie Chaplin was always turning caterpillars into butterflies. He had used comedy to reveal, and not flee, the truth of the human predicament. He'd roller skated blindfolded over the void, like a planet circling a black hole. He filmed a factory worker sucked into a machine, fed through its cogs and gears, assailing an age that turns people into things. And Charlie Chaplin had battled the bleak world with what? Not a knife, not a gun, a cane. Gentle, gestural, the baton of a maestro. Chaplin's cane, with no disrespect to Hockney, Picasso, or Basquiat, was in this moment what Jim Carrey most wanted to save. And intending to do just that, he walked against the broiling heat into his living room, grabbed the delicate object from its lucite brace, clutched it to his chest, and made for the door, when with an awful crash, the tallest of his weeping willow trees fell through the roof, splitting the support beams, trapping Jim Carrey between his overturned glass dining table and a nest of burning vines. Still, he clung to Chaplin's cane. Still, he hoped for escape to crawl out to his Range Rover, parked safely on the street. As the fires soared, as his central air system, set to maintain an internal temperature of 68 degrees, drew on generator power and sent a final burst of air through the house, whipping the shattered home into a proper inferno, Carrie began to barter with the cosmos for salvation. He'd repent, he swore. He'd renounce all earthly delights. If it was fun, he'd avoid it. He'd change his name to Francis or Simon Peter, and if the cosmos wanted to throw in some special power or skill, like healing the sick or talking to birds, something to distinguish him from others in this new field of endeavor, and also maybe a small group of followers, nothing huge, but dedicated believers. Well, all that would be appreciated. Unnecessary, but appreciated. "Save me," he prayed, cowering. "Please." The flames lapped higher. The roof hissed and groaned. The heat was baking his eyeballs. Another blast erupted by the front door. He assumed it was the oil tank exploding. "I'm gone," he thought. He closed his eyes, a sailor yielding to the deeps, waiting for some final narrative, completing vision that wouldn't come. "This is it," he thought. "Death, slow drifting into nothing." Then, as happens to heroes in myth and in cinema, he heard a saving voice, feminine and fearless, tender yet strong as steel, a cool, wet towel on the mind, singing the sweetest of songs, his name. Jim? Jim Carrey? Was this a hallucinated angel come to take him into the great forgetting? "Yeah," he sobbed fearfully. "I'm here." "Where?" "I'm in the new solarium," he gasped, looking up through the torn ceiling, a final joke. "You can't miss it." Then through the smoke, the choking stench of burning plastics, he saw them. The Daughters of Anime, an elite group of radicalized war veterans, all missing at least one limb, all come to save him from his world. "My house," said the star, deliriously, as the tallest of them lifted the dining room table off of him with a single awesome power squat. "My house!" "Let it go." "My things!" "Rejoice in the lightning of your load." "Who are you?" Chaplin's cane held tight against his chest. He puzzled over these women in their oxygen masks and aluminized fire suits. "We're the DOA. The Daughters of Anime?" "Relax." They fitted a respirator on his face, picked him up by the limbs, carried him from his would-be grave out into the foyer. He studied the waves of fire rippling across the ceiling above their heads.